Well, we'll pick up where we left off last week. We're still working off of handout 9, if you have that. And we'll also be referring to this figure, the Hasmonean dynasty, today, so you could kind of have that handy. But last week, we got into the what's called the Maccabean Revolt, and we kind of read through some of the source passages from 1 Maccabees. And I'll just do a quick review of what we went over last week, and then we'll pick up where we left off. You remember the story that we told last week about Mattathias and his sons revolting when they were asked to offer sacrifices in their village of Modin, which is northwest of Jerusalem. Mattathias and his sons revolted against the command to do that and ended up fleeing to the hills. And then we read about how the resistance movement grew as more and more people joined the movement, the resistance, also fleeing to the hills. And then actually not long after the revolt started, Mattathias died, and his son Judas picked up the mantle as the leader of the resistance. And he was called Judas Maccabeus, which means the hammerer, and the Maccabean revolt is named after him. He had a number of successes as he organized and had a growing army that he was able to draw upon. Think of it as sort of a guerrilla warfare in the Judean hills against the Seleucid rulers and the Syrian troops that were sent to suppress the revolt. He had a number of successes, though, and gradually gained more and more power until the point where 3 years after the temple was desecrated, he was able to storm the Temple Mount and recover the temple, rededicate it, and then that feast is celebrated ever after as Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights. And we read about how that came about from the passage in 1 Maccabees. And then that's, of course, the Feast of Dedication is referred to in the New Testament and was celebrated in Jesus' day. And it's still celebrated today among the Jews. So that kind of brings us up to where we left off. That's a quick recap of the early stages of the revolt and the early successes that the Maccabees had. So the next section I have titled here, Subsequent Events. Well, Judas was able to establish control of some of the towns outside of Jerusalem. He was able to take a number of the towns and sort of gradually expand the control that he had over the Judean territory. He also, interestingly, he petitioned Rome for a peace treaty about this time. We haven't really talked much about what's going on in Rome. We'll kind of talk about that in a little bit when we get to the rise of Rome, which I think is in the next section. But Rome at this point in time was growing in power, and we've already witnessed the way that they exerted power in Egypt when they turned Antiochus IV back from his conquest of Egypt, and you remember that story, which was really the catalyst for his persecution in the temple in Jerusalem. But Rome was gradually becoming more and more powerful. If you're familiar with Roman history, this is exactly the same time that the Punic Wars were happening with Carthage. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a week or two. But they were basically having success, and they were beginning to expand westward. And so they were beginning to become recognized as a power in the region. And so Judas actually sent a delegation to Rome, and they were received favorably. And there was a decree made, I think, by the Roman Senate that they were friends of Rome and should be protected. Of course, Roman policy at this point was to try to suppress the people who would be in competition with them. And so they probably viewed the Syrian power in the east as a threat or something that was going to have to be reckoned with. So it's pretty natural that they would support a rebel group that was fighting against the establishment at the time. So it's not at all surprising that they received the Judean contingent favorably. So they had an interest in restraining the Seleucid power, but there really was no practical help that they offered here. It was just words. They didn't actually do anything to help the Maccabees. So we'll see that treaty renewed later. But anyways, after consolidating his position in Jerusalem, that is Judas, he laid siege to the Acra, which is the citadel that we've mentioned a couple times on the Temple Mount. Even though he had stormed the temple and retaken the temple, the Syrian garrison was still there in the citadel, which was a stronghold. He did lay siege to that in 163 BC, so this is a year later after the capture of the temple. But the Seleucids sent an army under the command of a general by the name of Lysias to besiege Jerusalem and reestablish control. And basically, they sent an army and Judas was in trouble again, so there was this constant battling going back and forth. But what was going on in Antioch was there were a lot of political struggles happening in Antioch, which is the capital of the Seleucid dynasty. And you remember, I don't have that handout with me here, but the handout that has the Seleucid kings on the right-hand side, those kings, after Antiochus IV was killed, it was basically constant battling amongst the power groups there. And so all of those battles, if you look down the sheet there and see all those names, a lot of them are in parallel on the sheet, and that's because they were vying for power all at the same time. You remember the Seleucid rulers had kind of split. There were two lines of people who were claiming the throne, and they were kind of ongoing battles. So the political struggles in Antioch, as well as Judas's establishment of his own military strength, led him to be able to get a favorable settlement out of the Seleucid general Lysias. So basically he negotiated because of these things. The Seleucids were not really in a position of strength because of the political battles going back on at home. And so the agreement that they came to was that he would withdraw the siege of the citadel, they would withdraw their siege of Jerusalem, and yet they would maintain political control. But what he got out of the Syrians or Seleucids was a recension of Antiochus' decree outlawing Judaism. So he was able to get that concession that that decree would be rescinded. So Jewish religion was no longer forbidden under the Seleucid rulers. There was an amnesty declared to the Jews. And something else that happened, you remember the high priest at the time, the Hellenizing high priest was Menelaus, which we talked about earlier. Menelaus was taken to the Seleucid rulers and was eventually executed. So that all happened with this negotiation that Judas was able to accomplish with the Seleucid rulers. There was a lot of battling that continued to happen, though. There were skirmishes all the time. I mean, remember, there's two different camps of Seleucid powers here, so they were at one point or another vying for power with and fighting against the Jews. And so the battles continued, and Judas was actually killed in battle in 160 BC. You can read the story in Maccabees or in Josephus. It's a very heroic battle where it was against vastly superior odds. A lot of his army left him, but with 800 troops, he went up against a far superior Syrian force, and they were defeated, and he fell in battle in 160 BC. So you can see from the fact that he was killed in battle, even though they had had some initial successes, there was still very much a power struggle going on in Judea. The military struggles really continued. So the initial aim of the Maccabeans, of course, was a religious goal, which was to regain control of the temple, regain their ability to worship freely as Jews according to their traditional religion. And they had pretty much accomplished that. But after that, there was more of a thirst for political independence as well. So basically a return to getting rid of the overlords altogether. So that aim of full political freedom meant that the battle was going to continue against the Seleucid rulers. And that battle pretty much continued all the way to about 125 BC. So that would be about a 40-year battle if you want to think of it that way. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention is we mentioned last week that this contingent of pious Jews called the Hasidim or the Hasidians arose at this time. We have the first reference to this group of people. And it's commonly stated that they were completely on board with the revolt as long as it was targeting religious freedom, but that after they had regained religious freedom, that group of people would have withdrawn their support, their military support, from the Maccabeans because they didn't want to necessarily go for full political freedom. And so that's the common interpretation of the Hasidians' role here in supporting the Maccabees. That is debatable, I think, what their role was. There's some folks who dispute that idea. In other words, that they continued their support of the Maccabees throughout the end. But at any point, whether they broke off their military support or not for the Maccabees, it's likely that this group of pious Jews were becoming more and more opposed to the Hasmoneans at this point. Particularly after we haven't quite got this far yet, but we'll read about the next two Maccabees that took over power here. But following the actual brothers of Judas, when the descendants of the Maccabees began to rule, we'll see that the story becomes one of more and more secularization of the leadership and the priesthood. And it's probably likely that the pious Jews would have started to react against that secularization of the rulers, which was really not significantly different in the end from the Syrian rulers that they were revolting against. Anyways, what were some of the factors in the success of the revolt? You know, you've got a ragtag bunch of guerrilla fighters who were able to overthrow a fairly substantial military power in the Seleucids at this point in time. Probably, just like often as these revolts start in world history, the Seleucid rulers likely underestimated the Maccabean resistance. They probably underestimated their tactics and their ability to score victories. But later on, after the initial surprise, they began to be really preoccupied with other things. They were preoccupied in the east. There's a group called the Parthians, which continue to be involved in military struggles at this time. They're from the east. It would be the eastern part of the Seleucid Empire. I guess it would be Iraq probably today, but it would be northeast of where Jordan is today. The Parthians were a fairly substantial power, and the Seleucid rulers were preoccupied with battling them at this point in time. Later on, the Romans would be battling them. So because of their preoccupation with that, it was to their advantage to make concessions to the Jews in order to secure peace in that region so they weren't dealing with an internal revolt as well as external resistance. So that was probably one of the reasons they were willing to proclaim religious liberty for the Jews so that they could establish peace in that area and not worry about it. And then I mentioned the internal political factors, the constant battling between the two Seleucid families also led to ineffective control of what was going on in Judea. So all of those things were probably factors in how the Maccabeans were able to revolt and get some successes against the Syrian rulers. It's not unlike every time that something like this happens in world history. The circumstances are providentially arranged so that it's a certain outcome is favorable. If you're a student of history, pretty much every major success in a battle or something like that, a conquest, falls into that category where circumstances just lined up right for things to happen. And that was no different here. So with that, we'll go to the successors of Judas. Are there any questions or comments at this point? Yes, Dave. The question is, was there any emphasis on actually retaining the land and maybe restoring the borders of ancient Israel? That's wrapped up in the political aspect, I think. We'll see under the subsequent Hasmoneans that they had a desire to continue to expand their territory. And it's implicit in that their expansion is to regain the territory that they would have had under the largest part of the monarchy, for instance. So I think that's built into the political nature. Not only do they want to be free, but they also want to get back their ancestral lands, if you will. So I think that is part of it. Anything else? Okay. Well, we'll pick up here and look at what happened after the death of Judas. And here you want to probably refer to your handout. This is a very simplified family tree of the Hasmoneans. I noticed a lot of you took advantage of Dave's thriftiness in getting us the new ESV study Bibles. There's a really good family tree in the study Bible. I don't know if anyone has it here with you, but in mine it's on page 1613. there's a Hasmonean family tree there. It's more detailed than the one that I've handed out here, but it didn't copy well, so I just went with the simplified version here. At any rate, Jonathan took over after Judas's death. He was a brother of Judas, if you remember. And after Judas's death, their military leader was gone. And so the Jews came under heavy pressure again from the Syrian rulers. And they basically went to Jonathan and said, "Be our ruler again. Lead us in battle like Judas did." He accepted that call and he became a very strong military leader, similar to his brother. But he also combined that with a good political savvy and negotiating skills. And one interesting thing under Jonathan's leadership was that because of the concessions that he was able to get out of the Syrian rulers, the Seleucid rulers, he was actually awarded the title of high priest in 152 BC by the Seleucid ruler. And the Seleucid ruler at this point was someone by the name of Alexander Ballas. And he was in constant battle with the other family, which was led at the time by Demetrius. So you might remember that name. And you'll see these names again recurring over and over again. Alexander's, Demetrius, things like that in the Syrian line. But that is interesting. You remember the priesthood. So Menelaus was the Hellenizing priest who took over and was really one of the instigators in the great persecution in bringing Antiochus into the temple. He was still in power up to 161 BC. And then, if you remember from when we looked at the priesthood a few weeks ago, Alcimus was someone who was appointed after that. And he was in power up to 159. And following his death, the priesthood was vacant at that point in time. And it was vacant pretty much until Jonathan took up the title of high priest in 152 BC. What's interesting about that is Menelaus was the Hellenizing priest, but he was still the priest during the time of the Maccabean Revolt, even after the temple was cleansed and rededicated. That happened in 164. Menelaus was the high priest until 161. So it's interesting that he was still the high priest, even though the Maccabees had retaken the temple and restored the worship. What that says is you can see that they didn't really have control. The appointment of the high priest was still under the Seleucid ruler at the time. And so that's just a testimony, I think, to the fact that the Syrians were still the political rulers, even though the Maccabees had won a lot of religious freedom and had won some military battles. It's not like the Maccabees completely took over and the Syrians were gone and they weren't in power anymore. The fact that the Syrians still had a garrison in the citadel, that was a sign of their strength, that they were still in political control of the situation. And we see it here in the appointment of the high priest, that Menelaus was still in the high priesthood. Except when Judas was able to negotiate that truce with the Syrian ruler, one of the conditions of that truce was that Menelaus would be hoisted out of there. And he was taken out of there and he was executed. If you get the impression that the Maccabees had a lot of power, it wasn't really like that yet. There was still a lot of power struggle going on. Interestingly, though, this is the first time that one of the Maccabees took up the position of high priest. He accepted the title of high priest. And so after a 7-year absence, there was a high priest now, and it was Jonathan. Now, Jonathan also renewed the peace treaty with Rome as well as Sparta. There was an earlier peace treaty that I didn't mention with Sparta. Again, he renewed that peace treaty. He sent a delegation to Rome. He renewed the peace treaty that they had had under Judas. Again, there was no practical benefit of that at this point in time. Now, Jonathan was treacherously murdered, basically. He was deceived, captured, and eventually executed by Tryphon, who was one of the Seleucid rulers vying for control, again, in the Seleucid household. And there's a story you can read about how he was basically duped, captured, and then later executed by Tryphon. Yes. The question is, what about the Levitical priesthood and the Aaronic priesthood? We sort of covered that already in a previous class, but the legitimate line of the priesthood was represented by the son of Onias III, who was the last Zadokite priest in the high priesthood before he was removed by the Syrian ruler. His son, Onias IV, had fled to Egypt and established a temple in Egypt. They actually built a temple in Egypt. And that's, so the, it's interesting, the legitimate line was actually in Egypt at the time. And Jonathan's assumption of the high priesthood was viewed sort of both way, hot and cold, by different people. So it was recognized that he wasn't a legitimate high priest. But on the other hand, he was probably better than what they had had before. So it was viewed, I think, as a political expediency to have him as a high priest at that point in time. But we'll see in a few minutes how that led to trouble later. Okay, so we're going to talk about the next brother, Simon, here in a minute. But while Jonathan was kidnapped, the people went to Simon and asked him to take over in Jonathan's absence, which he did. And then there's a story about how he sort of tried to negotiate for Jonathan's release, but they had no intentions of releasing him, and they ended up killing Jonathan. So Jonathan's legacy was that he had obtained large gains by shrewd diplomacy. He exploited the Syrian political competition that was going on. He was able to extract deals from the two different Syrian families at the time. I skipped over all that. There's a lot that could be said there, but I just closed it here with a long quote from Klausner, which is again from this 7-volume set of the Jewish religion. In this section, this essay is called The First Hasmonean Rulers, Jonathan and Simeon. Anyways, Klausner says, "Politically, Jonathan had indeed achieved much. Jonathan turned a small band of enthusiasts into a people. From the leader of a small band, he became the head of a nation, and from a hunted rebel, high priest, commander of a national army, and almost the independent ruler of his country. He conquered practically all the cities of the Syrian Greeks and Hellenized Canaanites in Judea and Galilee. Jonathan thus paved the way for the complete liberation of Judea. All that remained for his brother Simeon to do was to proclaim Judea's independence and to obtain confirmation of this from the king of Syria." So Jonathan was actually a very able ruler in place of his brother Judas. Now, I spoke about how Simon was approached and asked to take over in Jonathan's absence. He was actually the oldest son of Mattathias, and he had been the leader of the troops during Jonathan's rule, and he took over leadership after Jonathan's death. It's interesting to note that, quite in contrast to the Syrian rulers, that the Syrian family battles that are going on at this point in time, and what happened later under Herod with all of his sons vying for power and basically killing each other off and everything, it's very interesting that the Maccabean family seems to be completely united. There doesn't seem to be any hint of any infighting or, you know, I want to be in charge. No, I want to be in charge. They seem to be humble men who basically were forced into leadership. And you see this happen with first Judas, then Jonathan, and then Simon. He was the oldest son, and he came third. But he secured Jewish independence. You can see from the previous quote that pretty much all that was left to do at this point was to get independence. And he secured Jewish independence with an agreement with the Seleucid ruler at the time in 142 BC, and that was Demetrius II. And they joined forces against a common enemy, which was Tryphon, the one that had executed Jonathan. So that represents the rival family there in the Seleucid line. But Simon was able to get an agreement with Demetrius and really obtain Jewish independence. Simon was the one who finally expelled the Syrians from the citadel, which effectively ended the control or the role of the Hellenizing party in Jerusalem at the time. So now the Syrians were pushed out, and it would not have been wise at that point in time to be a Hellenizer anymore in Jerusalem. There was no Syrian control anymore, and that was effectively the end of the Hellenizing party in 141 BC. Simon also sent a delegation to Rome, renewed the peace treaty again with Rome and Sparta. Again, no practical benefit to that at this point in time. And I'll skip over all the great things that happened under Simon's reign, just like we did with Jonathan, but I will read from 1 Maccabees sort of this idealized account of his time in office. This is in 1 Maccabees chapter 14. You'll hear this as an idealized account, but it's based in fact. So you can see that they were very pleased with what happened under Simon. And you'll also hear echoes here of Old Testament language of prosperity and things like that. So it says here in 1 Maccabees 14, "The people farmed the land in peace. It produced its crops and the trees in the plains their fruit. Old men sat in the streets talking together of their blessings, and the young men arrayed themselves in splendid military style. Simon supplied the towns with food in plenty and equipped them with weapons for defense, so that his renown spread to the ends of the earth. Peace was restored to the land, and throughout Israel there was great rejoicing. Everyone sat under his own vine and fig tree, and there was none to cause alarm. Those were days when no enemy was seen in the land, and every hostile king was crushed. Simon gave his protection to the poor among his people. He fulfilled the demands of the law and rid the country of renegades and evil men. He enhanced the splendor of the temple and furnished it with a wealth of sacred vessels." So you can hear a little bit of the idealism in there, but you can also see that Simon was very successful in restoring the fortunes to the people at that time. So during Simon's rule, you know, we've read the account here. It's obvious that he was in favor with the people. During his rule, the Jews began dating documents to his reign. So that kind of gives you an idea of the importance that they placed upon his regaining independence here. Here's the exact quote from 1 Maccabees 13. "The people began to write on their contracts and agreements in the first year of Simon, the great high priest, general, and leader of the Jews." So that's significant that they recognized Jewish independence and they recognized that Simon was the one who had gained independence for them. Now, it goes on, the Jewish council after that made another proclamation, which is interesting. After independence was secured, Simon was proclaimed not only the civil ruler and not only the military ruler, but high priest again. So now, Jonathan was proclaimed high priest by the Seleucid ruler because that was their right to do that at the time. It was viewed as a political appointment because it was a position of power in the area. Now, there's Jewish independence. And so, what are they going to do with the high priesthood? And this goes to some of the earlier questions. It's very interesting that they proclaimed him civil, military ruler, but also high priest forever by the Jewish council in 141 BC. But there's a caveat to that, which is an interesting caveat. They effectively established his family as the hereditary priests by doing this. Okay, so now we've got a new hereditary priesthood. But they put this on the end. He's a high priest forever until a true prophet should arise. So there's a recognition, again, that this isn't the Levitical priesthood. There's also a recognition that there's something more to come. So this is the prophet, right? They're looking forward to the prophet, and we know from the Old Testament and the New Testament that the prophet to come was Jesus, you know, with the forerunner of John, as you said, the Presbyterian, who baptized. So there's a couple interesting points about this caveat until a true prophet should arise. First of all, I think it shows that they recognized that this was a temporary situation. They were still looking for something more to come. Secondly, it shows that there is an expectation of a prophet to come. And we'll see that later when we look more carefully at messianic expectations of the day and in some of the literature that was being written at this period. There's definitely an expectation that there's someone yet to come. And here it's a prophet. And then there's one other interesting thing here. Until a true prophet should arise, there's an implicit recognition here, isn't there, of divine silence. There's an implicit recognition that there is no prophet here in this period in between the Testaments. And so, you know, the period that we call the 400 silent years, there's a self-consciousness there that there is no divine revelation happening during this period. And so I think this is a very interesting statement made by the council. The majority of Simon's reign was peaceful. You could tell from the passage from Maccabees that it was viewed as a very peaceful time when there were no external interferences. All of the rebels had been cast out. What did it say? The renegades and the evil men had been defeated. Just like in all these political battles, it doesn't end well for Simon. Simon and two of his sons were treacherously murdered by his son-in-law, Ptolemy, in 134 BC, which ended the rule of the direct sons of Mattathias. That was the last of the Maccabee sons. So technically, this is the end of the Maccabees, and then after that, it's typically called the House of Hasmoneus or the Hasmonean dynasty. This is, for reference, this was in 134 BC, so this is about 30 years after the temple had been recaptured and rededicated. And we'll see now how the sons of Simon began taking over at this point. Any questions or comments before we get into there? Yes, Jen. The question is, would there have been an expectation that when he was killed, that maybe now was the time, because he was the high priest, you know, maybe now was the time the Messiah may come. There's definitely a messianic expectation throughout this period, but nothing specific that says here that, you know, oh, that was the end, you know, because by making him a high priest forever, they were basically saying it's a hereditary priesthood, and he had a son. Yeah. It was probably natural that his son would take over at that point. He had many sons. Two of his sons were murdered along with him, but there's more left. Well, if you look under Simon, his son that's going to take over is John Hyrcanus. Like I said, this is an abbreviated chart. If you look at the one in the study Bible, it has all of them. Well, at least it has all five of Mattathias' sons, and it might have some of the other people too. It was just a power play. It was just treachery based on a desire to, I want to be in charge. I'm going to kill the ruler and, by the way, two of his sons. And now I'm going to take over. You know, it happens over and over again. And actually, it's going to happen a lot in this mess down below. So get used to it. This is not the reign of the true Messiah here, or the true high priest. John Hyrcanus took over. He was a son of Simon. And he succeeded his father. Ptolemy made a power play. He actually killed not only Simon and two of his sons, but he had Simon's wife, which was John Hyrcanus' mother, held hostage. And when John came and besieged the city where he was holed up, he actually held the mother up, and she was being subjected to torture. And he was saying, basically, on the city wall, this was in sight of John Hyrcanus, I'm going to torture your mother until you leave me alone. So he actually withdrew the siege. Ptolemy went ahead and killed her anyways and fled out of the country at that point. So that's pretty much the last we hear of Ptolemy. He fled out of the country. So he was actually killing his, I believe that was his mother-in-law, if you can keep all that straight. But it was John's mother. And so he went ahead and killed her, but then he fled the country and John took over as the high priest and the ruler of the people. Now, about this time, the Seleucid ruler came back on the scene again. So the period of prosperity and peace under Simon was about to come to an end. Okay, so about this time, the Seleucids come back in again. The Seleucid king Antiochus the VII, if you still have your Seleucid family tree there, you'll find him on there. You know, we started with Antiochus the IV under the persecution. Now we're to the VII, so that gives you an idea of where we are. He came and besieged Jerusalem. He forced concessions and basically a return to Syrian vassalship, but they still had religious freedom at least. So there was no return to the persecution of Antiochus the IV. After this man, Antiochus the VII, died, the Syrian princes really began a complete battle amongst themselves again for leadership, and their power basically continued to weaken at that point because they were fighting amongst themselves. And so John was able to reassert political control in 128 BC, and he was able to establish full independence again in 125 BC. So we're down to 125 BC now. He also expanded the territory. They were still expanding the territory back to the original expanse of the monarchy. He added Idumea, which is the territory south of Judea. He added Samaria and part of Galilee to the territory that was under Jewish control at this point. And then by way of commentary here, we'll try to get through this part and then we'll close. We're almost out of time here. So here we begin to see the friction with the high priesthood, as well as some of his actions. Hyrcanus's actions as a ruler really strained his relationship with his people. And so up till now, the people had been fairly pleased with the sons of Mattathias, the first generation of the Maccabees. But now, under the first one who's of the next generation, we begin to see that relationship strained. He was the first Jewish leader to mint his own coins with his own image. So you can see how that might be viewed unfavorably by the Jews. He was also the first Hasmonean to hire foreign mercenary soldiers, which was the common practice of the day. The kings of Syria did that. They hired mercenary forces from foreign countries. And Hyrcanus began to do that. Rather than using a standing Jewish army at this point in time, he began to hire mercenaries. Another thing he did, in order to pay all these debts, to pay his mercenaries, to pay off Antiochus when he besieged Jerusalem, he paid him off so he would leave and could get that concession. He opened David's tomb and basically robbed it. He took all the silver out of David's tomb in order to pay off all of these debts that he had incurred. Once again, you can see how that would be viewed by the Jewish people. David, of course, was well known as the premier king. To top it off then, because of all this, the Pharisees now began to openly oppose the priesthood of the Hasmoneans. And so this is the point earlier. Were the people happy about this arrangement with the priesthood? They were accepting it, but they weren't necessarily happy with it. And the minute it started to turn south and get secularized, they began to openly oppose it. And the Pharisees began to openly oppose the priesthood of the Hasmoneans, and they went as far as demanding that Hyrcanus resign as the high priest. Incidentally, this is probably the first reference we have in literature to the Pharisees at this point in time. So just keep that in mind. Did you have a question? Why did he hire mercenaries? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think they were better than the Jewish fighters. I really don't know the answer to that. But it wasn't something that was viewed favorably. So it could have been his desire to be like the rulers around him. There's definitely hints of that, that they wanted to become more like the nations around them. And so the opposition of the Pharisees now, of course, was not viewed favorably by John Hyrcanus. So what happened is he had actually been favorably inclined towards the Pharisees at the beginning of his rule. But towards the end, when they began to oppose him openly, he basically switched his allegiance to another group. Who might that be, do you think, that would be in competition with the Pharisees? The Sadducees. Okay, again, the first references that we have to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, the Sadducees here, I have a quote, various lines from a man named Forster. The Sadducees were from the wealthy priestly nobility, state-supporting, and more prepared to make religious compromises to further their economic interests. So you can see how they would align well with opposing the Pharisees. State-supporting and more prepared to make religious compromises to basically be in good favor, in the good graces. So we see here the earliest signs of the rise of the parties within Judaism, the Pharisees leaning more towards the followers of the Hasidim, or the pious ones, and the Sadducees being more the wealthy nobility who were willing to align themselves more with the world powers at the time to accomplish their ends. So you see these compromises beginning, and then the rise of a conflict between these two parties. Well, Hyrcanus's rule was about 30 years, so this was a long time that he was in office. And we'll end there. We'll pick it up at his death next time, and we'll see. Basically, what we're going to find is it's going from bad to worse rather quickly at this point.